called another of Hazrat Kafir passed away in 1704, and her son was 36. It was the same year that he opened his large and academic section of Istanbul.
Amina Teslima was buried there in the Cerrahi Lodge across from the retreat room in the Maidan area where the ceremony of Zikr was performed. Upon the peer's own demise in 1721, his auspicious tomb was placed at the foot of her grave, a testimony to the noble hadith of the Prophet, paradise lies at the feet of the mother. Ladies, I like that. Proceeding in the way of the company of learned men, Hazreti Pir quickly assumed high positions. Basically, what I'm skipping over a lot of things. He studied at the Jirapasha school, which was across the street from where his house was. He studied many things from calligraphy and Quran, and he was basically what it was. He had moved up the ranks and was appointed to be the Qadi in Cairo. And we're going to pick up the story from there. It appears that Nuruddin was to have served as Mahrek, or foreign judge, in the Ottoman province known as Bilad al-Arabah, the so-called four countries, the region of the empire, an area which included Edirne, Bursa, Damascus, and Cairo, the last being the city where the judge resided. When the time arrived for Nuruddin to sail for Cairo, his ship was delayed for several days by inclement weather. Nuruddin's maternal uncle, having come to the landing to bid farewell to another statesman, Haji Hussein Effendi, invited Nuruddin to stay at his own mansion in Toyagar Hill in Uskadar until the ship sailed. Nuruddin's uncle lived across the street from the tekke founded by Salami Effendi, the second peer of the Jeldveti order, a lodge which was now presided over by the venerable Sheikh Hazrat Ali Khost in Delhi. That evening, with the aim of attracting his nephew to the mystical path, Nuruddin's uncle took him to visit the saint from Kostandim. As soon as Nuruddin entered the presence of the Sheikh, they exchanged salams, and there was an immediate recognition of kindred souls. Though he had never previously laid eyes on Nuruddin nor been informed beforehand of the visit, Sheikh Alauddin opened the conversation with words, "Welcome, my son Nuruddin." Young Nuruddin was deeply impressed with the Sheikh's awareness of the unseen and realized that here was a perfect guide to reality. After the night prayers, Nuruddin, along with the other visitors, were permitted to view the dervish's sacred ceremony of remembrance. As he listened to the powerful chanting of the dhikr and observed the intoxicating sway of the dervish's circle, his heart was drawn to join them. Soon Nuruddin was so deeply affected by the ceremony that he realized he would not be able to remain a spectator in his chair. Casting off his cloak and abandoning his seat in the visitor's enclosure, Nuruddin entered the circle where he experienced a state of complete ecstasy, his heart and soul captured by the net of divine love. Hazreti Nuruddin fell at the feet of the Sheikh and begged to be accepted as a dervish. Hazreti Kostandeli answered, "Nuruddin, my son, go, renew your ablution, and strip yourself of every worldly attachment, of everything other than Allah." Nuruddin immediately obeyed his order, relinquishing his call to be the chief Qadi of Egypt. He sent his accompanying steward, Yusuf Effendi, to return his insignia and official letter of appointment as judge. He further charged Yusuf Effendi to return to his father Abdul with the news that he was renouncing everything except his wife. Nuruddin requested that everyone consider him as dead and that all of his goods and property be distributed among his heirs. He asked his wife Hatija to take up residence with his parents. Nuruddin then retired to remove his worldly garments, perform his ablution, and don the dervish clothing which was presented to him by the Sheikh. Thereafter, Hazrat Kostandeli placed Hazrat Nuruddin in the retreat cell for a 40-day fasting helvet. Thus began Nuruddin's 7 years of dervish training in the mystic way under the direction of the Venerable Ali Kostanderi, a process that is said to have been carried out under the spiritual influence of the departed saint Hazreti Bektashi Vedi. After some time, Hazreti Nuruddin was permitted to return to his home to lead a simple life of devotion in the service of the Sheikh. In the year of 1115 Hijra, at the age of 26, Nuruddin Jarahi was declared a Sheikh. His master Hazreti Ali Alauddin conferred upon him the noble green turban of the Helvetia, along with the robe, and the staff of the order instructed him, "My son Nuruddin, go and open up your own circle." Meanwhile, in the weeks preceding this occasion, a certain Ismail Effendi, the muezzin of the Jan Feda Hatun Mosque in the Kaira Gumrik section of Istanbul, had received a dream in which the Messenger of Allah had instructed him to create a helvet area in the right side of his mosque. Ismail Effendi had immediately set about building a retreat cell, which was now ready. Aware of these events, Hazreti Alauddin Effendi appraised Sheikh Nuruddin of the mosque's whereabouts, indicating that a new tekke would soon open in the vicinity where Nuruddin would assume his teaching duties as Sheikh. Two older dervishes, Suleiman Velauddin and Mehmed Husamuddin, also charged with training responsibilities, were assigned by Hazreti Alauddin Effendi to accompany Nuruddin across the Bosphorus with instructions to initiate this new spiritual unfolding with an extended helvet in the Jan Feda Mosque. And so, with his two dervishes, Hazreti Nuruddin left Üsküdar, sailed across the Bosphorus to Balat, the old Jewish quarter of Istanbul on the Golden Horn. After making inquiries, they made their way to the narrow street where the small Jan Feda Mosque was located. There they asked directions of another man and received the reply, "Are you by any chance Nuruddin Jarahi?" Nuruddin answered, "You must surely be Ismail Effendi, the muezzin who is expecting us." Ismail presented them with the key to the mosque and told Hazreti Nuruddin, "The Holy Prophet predicted that you would make helvet in this chamber and that very soon a noble lodge would be opened in the same neighborhood. He indicated that you are destined to devote yourself to the favors of the mystical path for the remainder of your life, with Monday being the special day of your lodge." Hazreti Nuruddin then went into seclusion, as did his two dervishes. They spent their days and nights in fasting and intense dhikr. They would attend congressional prayers 5 times a day, and in the evening Ismail Effendi would bring them food. Sometimes the meals were supplied by Haji Mullah Effendi, an ex-prime minister who lived across the street from the mosque and was very, very dedicated to the service of Hazreti Nuruddin. During this period, Sheikh Nuruddin and his dervishes were given to chanting the powerful Halveti dhikr into the night and every morning. This seems to have disturbed the sleep of one of the neighbors who lived next door to the mosque. This man was Tahta Bashir Bakir Effendi, or also known as Abu Avni, who was accustomed to making his prayers at the mosque. Now began to appear there, complaining bitterly about the loud nocturnal chanting. He claimed that he was unable to sleep most of the night and that the resultant fatigue caused him to oversleep the dawn prayers. On Friday after the noontime Juma prayers, Bekir Effendi came right up to Hazreti Nuruddin and began to shout at him in a most insulting and disagreeable way. Hazreti Nuruddin listened quietly and made no reply, but simply returned to his retreat cell. Bekir Effendi stormed out of the mosque and went back to his mansion in an angry mood. As he ascended the stairs of his own residence, Bekir Effendi suffered a stroke and fell back down the stairs, injuring his spine and paralyzing most of his body. When he came to, Bekir Effendi realized that he had brought this calamity on himself through his offensive behavior toward the saint. He said to his family, "Today I was extremely rude to the dervishes. Please see if Mehmet Nuruddin would come over here and breathe his healing breath on me." Hazreti Nuruddin felt pity for the man and came immediately. Bekir asked the Sheikh's forgiveness and received his prayers. Hazreti Nuruddin blew his holy breath over the man, and as he prepared to leave, Bekir Effendi said to him, "Should I die from this illness, I'm sure that I would find comfort on the other side if you would perform my funeral prayer and rites of purification. Please do not leave me without your grace." 3 days later, Bekir Effendi passed away. His body and coffin were brought to the Janfada Mosque, where Hazreti Pir gave him his final ablution and conducted his funeral prayers. He told the congregation, "All Muslims, Bekir Effendi has become a good man. I testify to this and have released him of debt in the hereafter. May all of you likewise affirm his goodness and acquit him." The people agreed, including Haji Mullah Effendi, who said, "If a Ketub such as yourself affirms his goodness and acquits him of wrongdoing, the rest of us will certainly follow your example." Haji Mullah Effendi went on to testify that he recognized Hazreti Pir to be the Ketub who was destined to sit on the post in Istanbul in the year 1115, as predicted 300 years ago by Sheikh Shanubi's Book of Saints. The estate left by Bekir Effendi was considerable. His mansion was adjacent to the small mosque, separated by a garden. When his heirs decided to sell off the estate, they sent heralds throughout the neighborhood beating drums and loudly proclaiming the auction. When they passed by the mosque, Hazreti Nuruddin said to the auctioneer, "We would like to buy the estate. To whatever bids you receive, still add a higher bid from us, regardless of the cost." That same night, the Holy Prophet appeared to the Sultan Ahmed III in a dream, commanding him to purchase the mansion and turn it into a dargah for Nuruddin Jerahim. The next day, when he related his dream in court, Haji Bashir Aga, does that name sound familiar? the same chief black eunuch. Of the royal palace, who had witnessed the miraculous appearance of Sheikh Ali Khost in Delhi in Medina years before, said, "My Padishah, I also had a similar dream. Furthermore, I understand that Sheikh Jarrah has shown a desire for that place." When the Sultan was apprised of the mansion's value, 300 pieces of gold were issued, an imperial edict authorizing the money to be sent to Hazreti Nuruddin for the purchase of the mansion. One of the Sultan's imams, Yahya Effendi, carried the gold to Hazreti Nuruddin and presented it to him along with greetings from the Sultan. Hazreti looked down and lifted the corner of his sheepskin upon which he knelt, revealing the wealth far in excess of what the Sultan had sent. "You see, we are not in need of money. All we ask is permission to establish the dargah." As he gazed upon the noble Sheikh Yahya Effendi, began to experience a great state of ecstasy and divine longing. He fell at the feet of Hazreti Nuruddin and asked permission to become his dervish, which was granted. He returned the money to the Sultan with Hazreti Pir's greetings and secured release from his position as royal imam. Sultan Ahmed decreed that the mansion be purchased and torn down at once, and a new dervish lodge constructed in its place. A royal endowment was also established for the tekia, which drew its sustenance from the proceeds of a silver wire factory in Bayezid, established by the Sultan's mother, Emirtullah. This dargah, the principal Asitani lodge of the Jerahi order and final resting place of the pier of the noble pier, still stands today. Wow. Yep. Any questions so far? Am I boring you? Nobody's bored yet? To skip through some of this. So, when the dargah was built and Hazrat Pir was to be installed on the sheepskin, all of the sheikhs from all around Istanbul, the grand sheikhs of all of the orders, they received dreams from their peers. Much of what we do are gifts, much of what you see are gifts from other tariqats. For example, the blue post. This comes from the Jalvatiya, I think, from the Hazreti Pir Hudai, who appeared to the Sheikh of the time to come and bring this. The red post that you see that we use sometimes, actually we haven't been using them in quite a long time, but those are standard. Most of the high Taruk, they use the red post. The Jalvatiya under Hazreti Hudai, they use the blue post. The different forms that we use in the zikr are gifts from different tariqats. I mean, for example, when we stand in lines, this comes from the Rafais. When we collapse at the end of the zikr and everybody comes upon the sheikh and the yesma goes, yai. This is called the Bedawi Topu, which comes from the Bedawi Tariqah. Many of the different things that we have come as gifts from different tariqats. And when Hazrat Pir, it came time for him, and there was this huge ceremony in the inauguration of the dargah, Hazrat Ali Kostandedi came. And for those of you who have taken hand, when you approach Baba for the actual ceremony, you have two shariks, one on either side of you. And in Hazreti Pir's case, the one was Hazreti Ali Kostandedi, and the other was Sheikh Jevri Chelebi, who I believe was the Khalifa of Hazrat Hudai of the time. So there's other gifts. I told you before that the standing comes from the Rafais, but it's not completely true. It comes from the Qadariya and also the Sinaniya. And the chanting of Allah Yadayim comes from the Rafais. The kneeling, individual turning of Sultan Walid from the Mevlevi. Here, here's a whole list of them. There were also spiritual gifts, Jamal beauty from the Bedawiya, Jalal power from the Dasukiya, and the Rizza contentment from the Naqshbandiya. Spiritual permission was given to Hazrat Pir and the Jarahi in order to utilize a wealth of zikr practices from other Taruk. As I already said, the Bedawi Topu, the Wafa turn within chanting Hai Hai Hu comes from the turning of Sultan Walid from the Mevlevia. So all of these things have been incorporated into our zikr as Hazrat Pir was the Hatim al-Mujtahideen, the seal of the prophets. And all of them came and participated in the opening ceremony. Though the black post of the Meydanji, by the way, was a gift from Bektashia. So that was a very difficult piece of information to find out. It took me a long time to find it, where that one came from. It's not very well known, but Effendi knows. Alhamdulillah. There's a couple of stories here that I wanted to read to you. Here we go. This is an interesting story. Hazrat Pir had seven Khalifas who were Sudiman Badaruddin, Uskadar, Mehmed, Usamuddin, the Shartarikzadeh, Iman, Mehmed Iman, Yahya Murabi, Zayuddin, Mehmed Chalibi. I'm not going to read. Six of them were sent out to establish their own tekyas. Among the seven, only Suleiman Vilauddin remained at the Kara Gurmek Derg with Hazrat Pir. Perhaps owing to the importance of the position of Sheikh Vilauddin was to inherit Hazrat Pir, was at times very strict with him. And because of Hazrat Pir's youthful age, the older Vilauddin would occasionally ponder what it would be like to have an older white-bearded sheikh. On Friday, Vilauddin Effendi visited the Sunbul Sinan Lodge to enjoy the turning ceremony of the Sunbuli dervishes led by the elderly Sheikh Khoja Nuruddin Effendi. As he watched the elderly Sheikh, it occurred to him that his peer would be like Khoja Nuruddin if his beard was similarly white. No sooner had that thought passed through his mind than Khoja Nuruddin Effendi immediately came in front of him and put his hand on the Khalifa's breast, saying, "Vilauddin Effendi." Vilauddin Effendi was, "Be proud of your sheikh. His beard is black, but his heart is pure white than mine." Sheikh Vilauddin excused himself after the turning ceremony and returned to the Jarahi Lodge, where he lovingly kissed the hand of his master. And Hazrat Pir smiled and said, "Vilauddin, what splendors became manifest during your visit today?" Sometime later, this is one of the earlier lessons I actually got from Tosin Baba. A wealthy uncle of Sheikh Vilauddin, who had been one of the Sultan's grand viziers, died and left a small fortune to his nephew. Vilauddin consulted with Hazrat Pir about the inheritance and was warned, "O Suleiman, do you want the fortune here and now, or would you prefer the divine bounty awaiting for you?" By this question, Vilauddin understood that his master expected abstinence from worldly wealth and complete reliance on Allah on the part of his dervishes. Hence, Vilauddin went straight to his relatives and refused the inheritance, saying, "We have made ourselves unclean." But when one of his relatives insisted that he at least accept an elaborately ornamented green brocade cloak, which she had quilted for him, he made a small exception to the dervish rule and received it. Later, when Hazrat Pir saw the ornamented cloak which Vilauddin Effendi was wearing, he realized that potent measures would be necessary to counteract his beloved's Khalifa's, the persistent affection of his nephs. "Vilauddin," he said, "where did you get this cloak?" Vilauddin explained that when he distributed an inheritance to his other relatives, one of them gave him the cloak as a gift. "In that case," the peer said, "let us make the cloak your property to wear as long as you live. Let it be placed on your tomb when your earthly life is completed to serve as a lesson for future generations." The next day was Friday. On the way to Fatih Mosque in Kuba Lodge, the peer stopped in front of a cafe and asked Vilauddin to spread his new brocade cloth in the muddy street and had the baker feed scraps to the dogs on it. Then Vilauddin was told to put the cloak back on, which he did without hesitation. When they arrived at the Kuba Lodge of the Qadiris, Hazrat Nuruddin led Vilauddin to an empty lot across from the lodge. There he removed Alauddin's turban and tied the long hair of his noble Khalifa to a branch of a mulberry tree. He then took Alauddin's green turban and staff with him and entered the lodge. Inside, Sheikh Abdullah Effendi, the post Nashini of the lodge, beseeched Hazrat Pir to please forgive whatever transgression Alauddin had committed and allow him to come inside. Hazrat Pir consented to the request and went to the window and called, "Vilauddin, come in." Determined to strictly obey this command, the venerable Vilauddin dislodged his hair from the tree without untying it and rushed to the pier. When Hazrat Nuruddin saw that some of the Khalifa's hair had been pulled out and was bleeding from the scalp, he asked Vilauddin, "Why did you untie your hair first before coming. Oh, my Sheikh, answered Vilayuddin, you ordered me to come, I heard no other command from you. Tenderly Hazrati Nuruddin laid his hands upon the wound and began to gently massage it. Within moments the bleeding had stopped and the scalp was quite healed where the hair had come out. Hazrati Pir asked Vilayuddin to bring him the remaining hair from the tree, which when he received it, Hazrati Pir divided it between the Qadri Sheikh and himself, placing the hair reverently in his pocket, his breast pocket, lest this henceforth be preserved in both tekyas. The hair of Hazrati Vilayuddin is still preserved in the Jarahi Dargah in Karagumak as well as the brocaded cloak. Subsequent to these events, the Pir designated Hazrati Vilayuddin as his immediate successor as the post of Most in the Sheen of the Jarahiyah. So this is, there are many more stories, and it goes on for quite a ways, and then what happens, it goes into, it ends in the time of Fakhruddin Efendi. And that was also very pertinent to us. But I'm afraid it's getting... It's not late at all. Not charging. There we go. Any questions so far about Hazrati Pir? Do you know these stories? Well, I know you do, Baba. You've read it already? It's nice to be reminded of them. I reread it again today and just was so moved by it. The importance of Fakhruddin Efendi, Allah Almighty, listen, is, first of all, let's give you a little bit of a history. He took the position from his father. He was trained as to be the sheikh eventually when the time came, but it was a very, very difficult time. The end of the wars with the Greeks in the First World War, all of these things were going on, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire was happening, in which they attempted to, you know, close all the tekyas and this and that. There are many stories about how people came into the dargah and tried to take it over. And Fakhruddin Efendi, it actually took him quite a few years before he found a way to turn the dargah into a waqfa. And if you go there, you will see it. What does the actual sign say? Tasawuf. Yeah. It's okay, I understood.
The development of Turkish culture and foundation of Turkish culture.
Cultural music.
Culture and folklore.
Folklore music, yeah. And that's how they managed to. In the time of Kemal Atatürk, you know, there was most of the people of Istanbul within the population was roughly about 600,000, and many of these people actually belonged to different dergahs and tarikats throughout the city. And there were hundreds and hundreds of dergahs all across the city. Many of them, I forget the actual number, but it's in here. There was quite a huge number of Jarahi dergahs alone around the city, something like 60 or 80 or maybe even more. But there were some 700 or 800 dergahs around the city, depending on who you talk to. I've heard different numbers over the years. So anyhow, the people, the government officials were closing everything down. And Fakhruddin Efendi was basically fighting it. Even one day somebody came in from the government and was hammering up a poster that this was now, you know, belonging to the government, and Fakhruddin Efendi caught the guy, and actually Fakhruddin Efendi was not if you can try looking at the photographs up there, he was not a big stature, but apparently he took this guy and clocked him, and the guy went sailing across the courtyard. And you know, after that, I think he went into the tomb of Hazrat Pir, and he threatened to throw himself down the well if Hazrat Pir didn't do something to save the dargah. The long and short of it is that again, you can read it in the book. There comes a point in time when after Atatürk left power, he passed away. And it went to, how do you pronounce his name?
Inanu.
And Inanu had a dream. And of course, President Inanu had a dream, and he immediately found some Mevlevi sheikhs to try to interpret the dream. But by this point in time, this was like in the 50s. And So the Mevlevis had lost their gift for dream interpretation, but they knew that Fahreddin Efendi was still strong. And they came to see Fahreddin Efendi one day, and just as they were coming in, you know, he smoked his cigarette with a cigarette holder, and he shook it at them, and he said, "I know why you're here." And it's because he knew that Inanu had a dream, and the Mevlevis were coming to him for help in terms of interpreting the dream. And he said, "I'm only going to interpret this dream if you tell him who it was that had done the interpretation." There was another time when some construction workers came in and they wanted to dismantle the dargah. And apparently they started breaking through the floors and in where the tombs are, and apparently they hit some kind of some piece of stone or rock or dirt, and all of Istanbul began to shake as though there was an earthquake. And what's her name? Hala heard it, and she came running out of the dargah and ran into the tombs to stop these guys, because they started disturbing the ground where Hazrat Pir was. And it caused an earthquake type of an experience. There are many more stories about these kinds of things, but the idea really is just to give you a sense about the importance of our tariqat and its place. Sort of, this book does a very good job explaining its place in the history of all the other tariq, and also to try to, you know, impress upon you not to take it lightly. You know, the business of being in the Jarahi Dargah, in the Tariqat. We've talked a lot about reading and studying and this and that, but we were talking with somebody the other day who said they've already started taking the time to go on the internet and read Bubba's papers that are in the library section of the website, which is, I thought that was really wonderful. And you know, during the last few weeks, I keep going. Well, I don't normally go there, but because I have the papers, and I've been digging up all the old papers and looking through them, and found that all of those papers are still as fresh today as they were when they were given out. And some of them were given out as far back as 1980. So studying is a very important part of, you know, and reading these things and putting things into practice. Moldo. So, any questions?
I have a question. There is a well in the, and I was told once from a senior dervish that actually gives shifa, and they give the water when you are leaving, bottle by bottle, shifa water.
Uh-huh.
And then she explained that that's actually connected with the Zamzam, because one day they found a pot that come from there. So do you know?
I had not heard that before. I know the well exists. I know that the well is regarded really highly for, you know, Shifa water. But I've not heard that part. That there's a connection between that well and the well of Zendra.
Yes, and it was one of those archival writings, but...
I've not seen that.
No.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't... Yeah, we always try to, when we go there, try to get some of that water. But I don't know that. Mm. Wouldn't surprise me. Wouldn't surprise me. You know. So Faridun Efendi was the one who pretty much saved everything from, he had the great insight to protect the Dargah, protect the workings of the Dargah. When the Dargah was basically closed, they used to go, in those days, for those of you who are Turks, they used to go out to Floria and just read the weird. And this way they would be out of the Dargah, but they still maintained some of the practices, and it wasn't until I think sometime later that they began to reopen the Dargah a little bit and still maintain zikrs. Because there's a story of when Muzaffar Efendi Allah Medicine was the Khalifa and was put in charge, Faridun Efendi was very sick, but he nonetheless somehow managed to had a room over the Maidan, and he had a hole drilled in the floor so he could peek through and watch the Zafar Effendi lead the zikrs. But I don't know if that was really, because that's a very high ceiling, and I don't know how that would have been possible. But nonetheless, those are the stories they tell. But he took, for those of us who were around in the time of Muzaffar Efendi, all of the old babas who had been left over from Faridun Efendi's time, they were all taken. Faridun Efendi had the great insight to see. And even Muzaffar Efendi said, you know, that he would never have come to America and he would not have been who he was if it wasn't for the prayers of Faridun Efendi. Faridun Efendi was really an incredible and great sheikh. When he was drafted into the military, just before he left the Dargah, he went into the tomb of Hazrat Pir, and he complained. He said, "Nobody has ever shaved. This beard is a virgin beard. It has never been shaved, and I don't want to shave it for the military." He said, "You protect this beard." Faridun Efendi, I don't know how long his military service was, but he worked in the military and with a beard. And nobody in those days, those things were pretty much had been forbidden by Ataturk. The bearded men, the fez was forbidden, hijab was forbidden. All those kinds of things, even the ezan was in Turkish and for quite a long time. So he managed to serve in the military with his beard still on. I'm sorry, I just got a message, I need to respond.